Thanks, Betsy and Annie. Now it comes down to the good part of the evening. And, you know, God has such a plan. It's just sometimes it's just so amazing. You know, Michaeline was to be here, and you know, unfortunately she had family situations. And God knew all along that Lee was going to be here tonight, you know. And but I met her for the first time this afternoon, and immediately her spunk and her enthusiasm for this program was just very appealing to me. And everybody that I've talked with that's heard her says she gives a wonderful talk, and I'm just very anxious to hear her. And so without further ado, introduce Lee from Waxhaw, North Carolina.
All right. My name is Lee Savage. I am an alcoholic. It is always a privilege to be a service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got the call on Sunday night, I had to check in on a couple things because I did have a couple commitments this weekend. And what I found out is that those commitments had been canceled. I just hadn't found out yet. And so I said, you know, that's just all the information that I need. And I talked to my husband and I talked to my sponsor, and here I am. So what I'm going to do tonight is tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I do have a home group. My home group is Matthew's group, and we meet on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. I'm always there on Wednesday nights for the big book study group, and I have a firm foundation in literature. It's where I've always found a great deal of strength and knowledge and God as I understand him, and it's been several years now, and it just never ceases to amaze me how things work out when I earnestly seek him. My sobriety date is May 12th, 2002, and I've not found it necessary to take any mood or mind-altering substance since then, and that is by the grace of God and this fellowship. And I'll tell you one thing. You guys put the fellowship in Fellowship by the Sea. I have been here a couple hours, and I am just blown away at the faces I already know and the faces that, you know, I see right now. So people kept asking me, are you nervous? You know, I didn't have to study a book to know what I'm going to say tonight. I lived it. So I'm just going to do the very best that I can and, you know, tell you what I was asked to tell you tonight. And I'll just kind of start from the beginning. And as I mentioned, I do have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, so on and so forth. I do sponsor seven women, and it has been a great source of growth and enjoyment. And our book very clearly states that it is an opportunity that is not to be missed, and I'm grateful that I have not missed that opportunity. I grew up, right now I live an hour south of Charlotte, and I grew up an hour east of Charlotte in a tiny little town, and I grew up on the corner of two dirt roads, and my dad was an alcoholic, my mother was an Al-Anon, and it's just really interesting because both of them were only children. So they both wanted a really large family. Well, they were married before they got together, so they kind of had his, hers, and ours. So it wound up being a total of eight children. I am the last of eight kids. We were all raised in the same house together, so I've always considered them all my brothers and sisters. And it was just a big family unit in a really small farmhouse on the corner of the two dirt roads where we have a blinking light, a fire department, and a Presbyterian church. And, yeah, there's a term today that people like to use for, you know, the steps and the haves and, you know, all that, and it's called a blended family. And I think that is an absolutely beautiful term. You know, everybody comes together, and that's not what we had. We had Jerry Springer of the 70s, you know. we had all kinds of action going on in our household. You know, daddy's a drinker, mama's saving the day, and there's just all kinds of drug and alcohol use in my siblings already, because you got to remember, you know, I'm just a little girl. You know, there's varying ages all the way up to 20 years old. So when I was in kindergarten, I had way too much information about this disease. And I have it on a cellular level. I have it on a family level. I mean, you know, I've married twice, you know, one not in recovery, one in recovery. So, man, I'm just in it. And it's just, so I knew way too much about way too much growing up. And what I did is I internalized a great deal of responsibility for the things that happened in my household. And I would go to school and I would think, you know, if I made better grades, maybe daddy wouldn't drink so much. Maybe if I cleaned my room, that would help my mother. Maybe if I saved my money, I could help pay the bills. You know, I just took on a lot of responsibility in that household. And, you know, my parents weren't necessarily neglectful. It was more of like they were just spread way too thin. You know, it's just the trickle-down effect. There just wasn't a whole lot left. And, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And I just was not the squeaky wheel, you know, being a little kid in elementary school. You know, we had these teenagers doing all these other shenanigans, and that's who, you know, the attention kind of got funneled to. So I was very self-supervising as a child. Now, I would go to school, and now imagine this. I did good in a structured environment. And I would go to school and I would make these good grades and I would come home and I would just pray that nobody knew what was going on in my household. But the fact is, when you live in a place like I lived, people did. And, you know, this just continued to progress. And something I'd like to go ahead and interject now, because I don't want to forget to tell you this. Three of my siblings are dead as a direct result of this disease. All of my other siblings that are still living, everybody's got this disease. And I'm the only one in a 12-step fellowship. And I'll discuss my father in a little while. So I progressed through elementary school. I progressed through high school. Teetotaler, by God, it is not going to be me. Not going to be me. You know, I'm going to be the one who makes it out of this alive. And I had already realized education was probably going to be that ticket out of there, out of that little farmhouse, out of that chaos, out of everything that was going on. So I just fueled, all of my efforts went to school, and I did really good there. And I remember there was this one little girl that I could be friends with, and we could spend the night at each other's house because her daddy acted just like mine, and we knew how to keep the same kind of secrets. And I always resented her secretly because, you know, I didn't want to have to just be friends with her, you know, but I had to be. You know, it was what it was. So I went on into high school, got my driver's license. My brothers and sisters had kind of married and moved a tenth of a mile down the road and gotten a mobile home. And I'm telling you the truth. Not making this up. So, you know, they've married, they've had kids, you know, they're living a tenth of a mile down the road. So, you know, we've went to being a dysfunctional home to a dysfunctional community. And you know, once again, you know, my thought process was, it's not going to be me. It's not going to be me that's the alcoholic or with, you know, pregnancy and kids and trailers. You know, it's just not going to be me. And when I was 16, two very big things happened when I was 16. The first one was that my mother came home one day and she said, "Lee, I've got cancer." And I was like, okay, you know, I wasn't exactly sure, you know, what that meant or how I was supposed to necessarily react, but I knew that it wasn't good. And she told me she was going to get treatment and that, you know, things were going to be okay. And so I said, okay, things are going to be okay. And the other thing that happened that year is that my dad had a major health scare. My mother gave him an ultimatum: quit drinking or I'm gone. 2 weeks later, after not picking up any alcohol, he had a massive stroke. And he went to the VA hospital and came home a completely different man. My dad came home and never, to this day, has touched another drop of alcohol. He went to church. So he went from being a raging alcoholic, you know, it's all fun and games until daddy gets the shotgun out, to, "I'm going to church now." He estranged himself from my mother. He moved into another bedroom. So here was this little meek and mild Bible-toting man who I was very angry at. What do you mean, you know, Mr. Goodness? You know, you've just wrecked our lives for years and years, and now you're just going to, you know, ooh, you got religion, you know. So, you know, everything's just, you know, I had a lot of unfinished business with my father and didn't know what to do with it. You know, I'm 16 years old. I'm developing. I have no idea how to process this, and I had very little information growing up to go on. So I'm just at a loss as to what to do. So I just essentially finished high school, and my mother, May before I graduated high school in June, she fell ill again. And 3 months after she fell ill again, she passed away. And that was just such a difficult thing. I was supposed to go away to college, and I didn't because I wanted to stay at home and I wanted to take care of her because I knew she was dying. I would never change that. You know, I would never go back in time and change that. And it was always easy to think about what if. But the fact is I was right where I was supposed to be, and I would never trade those moments for anything in the world. We buried my mother and my brothers and sisters. You know, it's just me and my dad at home. And I had started school at the local community college. I took up cosmetology. And my mother was a hairdresser. And I just recently learned that when girls lose their mother at a very, very early age like I did, they try to become them subconsciously. And that's what I was doing. You know, I wanted her to stay alive, and I was going to be her. I look exactly like my mother. And it's really interesting because I didn't know that for a long time. And I finished, went into cosmetology school, got a job in Charlotte waiting, hostessing at a restaurant. Letha and I were talking earlier about the east side of Charlotte. You know, this is back when it was still safe. And that was in the early 90s. And I was up there, and I was hostessing. I was very lonely. I had no relationship with my father. I had unfinished business with God. My mother was dead. My brothers and sisters are married with children. I just felt like I had no place in the world. I felt orphaned. That's just where I was at. So do you see how all this is lining up? The sun, the moon, and the stars are all coming together for that one first night. I was in there. I was sweeping up peanut shells. It was a, you know, little steakhouse, you know, and one of the waitresses came over and asked me. She said, "What are you doing tonight?" And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know, just whatever." And she said, "Do you want to go out with us?" You know, and she was one of the big girls, you know. So I said, "Well, I can't really go out with you guys. I'm underage." And she said, "You look cute in your jeans. You can go anywhere with us." I said, "Okay." So I went out with them that night, and we just went just, you know, 0.2 miles down the road to this little bar and grill. And what happened that night, that process that happened that night was going to repeat itself for the next 9 years. What happened that night is I drank 5 electric lemonades, and that night I drank too much. I blacked out. I passed out. I threw up, and I made everybody very angry at me somehow. And I was late for work the next day. And but some point in time that night, at some point in time, I was tall. And I was beautiful. And maybe I really did look good in my jeans. And maybe I can dance. You know, all those things happened to me that night that you know, you're sitting here and you know what I'm talking about. That magic moment when suddenly I had a hole inside of me and I suddenly felt a whole lot better about it. And that night I had a problem. And I thought I had found a solution. And in essence, I had. The problem with that solution is that it was to later become my problem. And then I have a big gap where solution was again. So the way I like to describe that 9 years is in thirds. The first 3 years, there was a whole lot of fun and just a few consequences. I was young. I was resilient. Any type of little scrapes I had with the law, you know, that could have happened to anybody. I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, maybe I needed to change of friends. Maybe I needed to, you know, do this or that. And I had a couple of scary things happen. You know, I had a few little car accidents, and I had, you know, just some minor things happen with the law. But I knew that I knew that I probably needed to kind of slow it down a little bit. So I said, it's all this city living. You know, I'd moved to Charlotte. I said, that's the problem. The city's the problem. I need to just move back home to the country. And I'll just kind of slow it down a little bit and kind of regroup and regather. Now, I've still not got any kind of relationship with my father. You know, I'm in and out of, you know, bad relationships, you know, with boyfriends. And, you know, I've just got some running buddies. And I'm still essentially a very lonely girl. I moved back home with my dad. And he never really told me I could, and he never really told me I couldn't. I just kind of showed up one day and just moved in, and he didn't say anything, and we just kind of coexisted in the house, and I would just kind of rip and run, and he wouldn't say a whole lot, and I wouldn't say a whole lot. And that summer that I moved back home, I met this fellow that I had went to high school with, and we got to talk and whatnot, went out on a couple dates, and within a few months I was pregnant. And where I'm from, if you get pregnant and you're not married, you make it right. So we opted to get married, but prior to the marriage, I had a miscarriage. And, you know, once again, we wanted to do the right thing, so we got married anyway. And I'll tell you what I learned about my disease through that marriage. I learned that when you get married in active alcoholism, you have a front row spectator for all of your antics. You have a scorekeeper. You have a memory. You have a conscience all of a sudden, because they are going to tell you what you did last night eventually. And what I got from that marriage was that, you know, I don't really want you to tell me what to do or how to do it. You know, this is my thing. Don't touch it. So in the book, it talks about how we, you know, said we were going to, you know, just drink wine and take a trip and not take a trip with and without a solemn oath. We negotiated this disease to every possible angle when I was married, because, you know, well, I'm just going to drink, you know, six tonight. So what I knew I had to do was supplement all night long, so it could really just look like I was just drinking a six pack. And it was just so interesting, because no matter what I tried, no matter what we came up with, I needed to get to where I needed to be in a certain amount of time, and I couldn't do it on anybody else's timetable. So the constraints that I fell under with that marriage were just, I couldn't do it. So during the marriage, I discovered that he had an allergy to work. And I don't know. And I can't call anybody else an alcoholic. I can just say that there was some suspicious behavior. And he I was waiting tables day and night. And I was just getting really tired of what was going on. I felt like I was getting a lot of criticism and not getting a whole lot back from it. So I put myself back into school because, you know, this little girl showed back up, this little survivalist, you know, that grew up in the alcoholic home. She showed back up, and we went to school, and I turned out second in my class. And that is just an amazing thing, because I was in full-blown alcoholism. I was not a daily drinker, but I assure you I did not drink 2 days in a row. And, you know, I was managing all these things, a full-time job. I was going to school. You know, I'm trying to manage this household and whatnot. And the month before I graduated, I decided I needed to lose about 160 pounds. Because I said, you know, I've worked awful hard for this, and, you know, you don't deserve to come with me, the great places that I'm going with this degree. And I left him. I went and got a job at Carolina's Medical Center, and I had the tiger by the tail. Remember when Bill says that he had arrived? I had arrived. This is the first 3 years, the fun was high, the consequences was low, the tables were starting to turn, it was starting to get like this. you know, but I'm doing okay because I'm showing up for work. I got a degree. You know, everybody in healthcare, you know, I'm okay. I work at the hospital now. And I've got a good job and a good apartment on the right side of Charlotte. You know, things are okay now. And within 3 months, I got my second DUI. And the circumstances of this DUI are profound. I was driving home on Independence Boulevard, going to take a left on Albemarle Road. The intersection doesn't exist anymore. They did construction and kind of took it out. And the last thing I remember is cruising down Independence, and I woke up to the sound of crashing metal. What had happened is I had blacked out and passed out at the wheel, and I woke up hitting somebody who was dead stopped at the stoplight, and I was going full speed. Nobody died in that accident, and there's no explainable reason why. Absolutely not. The state of North Carolina was so impressed with me that they said I should take a break, and they gave me 4 years off and suggested that I go get an assessment. And I went and got my assessment. And when I did, you know how you try to negotiate those questions? You think, well, you know, I thought I was so smart. But what I was doing is I was just telling them, I'm an alcoholic. Yes, I'm an alcoholic. And the whole way through, I'm trying to say, you know, why do we always say I just have two beers? You know, what is it about two, you know? We know, you know I don't have one, but I don't want to say I had three. You know, I have two. And they put me in intensive outpatient treatment in this woman's group. And this woman, she wanted me to do these really crazy things like go to meetings. And she wanted me to get my paper signed. And she wanted me to get a sponsor. And I would go, and I would cry on cue, and I would pick up white chips, and I would come in on Monday morning, and she'd want to know what I did for my recovery, and I, for the life of me, could not understand why hanging out and playing with my cats all weekend didn't count. You know, I didn't drink. You know, that's enough, isn't it? And I really just felt like if she would just hear me out, if you would just hear the life I've had, if you would just hear the turmoil and the tragedy and just, you know, for the love of God, hear my story, you'll understand why I drink, you'll sign my paper, and you'll let me go home. And she wouldn't do it. She wanted me to write in this workbook about a first step, you know, and so I realized at that point that I was really going to only be in there a certain amount of weeks. That it really came down to how long my insurance was going to pay. So I really just toughed it out. And the longest that I went without a drink during that 8 weeks was 2 weeks, Tuesday to Tuesday. And I celebrated the following Wednesday by going out and getting drunk because I had proven that I could do it. You know, I did not drink for 2 weeks. There you have it. So 13 months after I exited that treatment, that next 13 months was the worst 13 months of my life. What happened is I had put a crack in the wall of my denial, and I had seen just a little bit of myself. The last days of my drinking went like this. I would work 3 or 4 days on at the hospital, and I would sit in my apartment for 3 or 4 days and do nothing but drink. And wake up and pass out and drink and wake up and pass out. And that's all I did. And I always set my days up in blocks so I could have a good little binge session. Because I knew that if I only had one day off, where I needed to get with the alcohol and where I needed to go, I couldn't do in recovery and get back to work. So out of damage control and out of my disease, you know, that's just how I structured my life. So along, you know, the beginning of May, I had a very pitiful existence. All I did was work and drink. I had ran off all my friends. I didn't talk to any of my family. I had no driver's license. So, you know, my life revolved around, you know, when the liquor store opened. I got off work at 7 a.m. The liquor store opened at 9. And I just prayed to God that I had enough between 7 and 9 to get me where I needed to be. So that way when it opened at 9, that I was okay again. I was supposed to go out with a girlfriend of mine, and we went out to see her husband's band play, and I had a house of cards arranged for the evening because I was going to have this big night out. And, you know, I had boyfriend A lined up. I had boyfriend B lined up. I had, you know, my best friend, the band, the liquor, you know. I had been drinking all day long. I get there. I had no idea both of them were going to show up. And out in the parking lot, all at once, both of my girlfriends, both of my boyfriends, and my whole house of cards came falling down that night. And there was no, you know, dramatic confrontation. There was no major scene. It's just like I had been walking around in the dark trying to act like nothing was wrong and everybody just needed to leave me alone. And somebody came through and flipped the lights on, and there I was. All of a sudden. And that was just the moment. And when that happened, I had the most profound spiritual thing happen to me that I've ever had happen in my life. I had a spiritually audible voice come to me and say, "Lee, go home." And in that moment, in that very moment, I knew that it was over. I went home that night. I caught a cab. I went home. And the next day, on May 12th, 2002, I did go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I did pick up a white chip. So that 8 weeks of intensive outpatient therapy served one purpose. It told me where to go when I was ready, and I went. I called that counselor, and I told her what had happened. And she said, "Well, good, if you ever need me, call me." She went into private practice, and, you know, that was it. And I told a couple of my girlfriends what I had done, and they said, "Yeah, whatever. Okay." And there was a little clubhouse there. Well, there still is a little clubhouse just above the hospital, and they had meetings at 7:15 a.m. They still meet there, 7:15 to 8 a.m., and I would get off work at the hospital, and I would go to that meeting every morning. I would ride or walk. I would either ride my bicycle or walk up there, and I would get off at 7 a.m., go to the 7:15 meeting, ride home praying the entire way because I still had to go by this liquor store, and I would go home, and I would go to bed, and that is the only thing that I did, you know, the first couple of weeks. I met a woman, and she became my sponsor. And in the home group that I was raised in, the women sat with the women. The end. It did not matter. It did not matter if you came in with your husband of 20 years. You sit with us. And I'm so grateful for that, because what that instilled in me is that the women stick with the women and the men stick with the men. And my sponsor made it explicitly clear to me that if I was not willing to give myself a chance in recovery, how was she? She needed something to work with. I was not married. I did not have children. There was no reason why I could not work these steps as a single female. And I did do that. And she was kind of intimidating too. She scared me. And what happened is I dug out this copy of this book, and she told me to read the first 164 pages. And for the first time, I saw things in this book that told me that I had a disease. It told me that after I take the first drink, that I was absolutely out of control. There's no way I could predict what was going to happen to me. It told me that I had a disease of the mind and of the body, and that I was currently suffering from spiritual bankruptcy, and that I needed to do something about all three of those if I intended to stay sober for any length of time. So the very first thing that was suggested to me is abstinence. Number one, do not pick up no matter what. And the second thing that was suggested to me was work the steps immediately. So she told me, she said, "Lee, what I want you to do is I want you to make a list of all the embarrassing things that, you know, that your top 10 embarrassing moments while you were out there drinking." And I said, "Well, I can do that, you know." So I made this list, and I went to take it to her. And she said, "No, I don't want to see your list." She said, "I just want you to put it on your refrigerator. Because if you get any bright ideas on whether or not you think you can have just one, I want you to read the list and then call me." I never had to call her. And I didn't really come in with a lot of disillusionment about powerlessness and unmanageability. It was very clear to me. I had no driver's license. I was a miserable person with no friends. And the only thing that I had was a desire to do something different. So we moved on to step two at that point, and what she told me about God set me free till this very day. She told me that God was open and that God was roomy and all-inclusive and never forbidding. She told me that I could choose my own understanding of God. And I said, you know, that sounds all flowery and cute and stuff, but I don't know, you know. I just don't know about this God fella. He took the wrong parent. You know, he took my mother. And now, you know, I don't even like my dad. You know, God's really made some mistakes. Why should I trust God? And what she told me to do is she said, Lee, I want you to write a best friend list for me. I want you to go through and I want you to write a best friend list. I want you to tell me who your best friend would be, barring absolutely nothing. I want you to tell me all the qualities that a good best friend would have. Well, I thought she was wanting me to write a list so she could fulfill all my expectations. I thought she was doing this so she could, like, get it right, you know? And when I took her the list and presented her, you know, it's like, da-da-da-da, she said, Lee, that's your higher power. And I said, surely to God it cannot be that simple. And she said, oh, yes, my child, it is that simple. That is your higher power. And when you come across a situation that you feel like you can't handle and you think it's not on that list, you're to add it to that list. You are to enlarge upon that God. And today, God as I understand God, I have a very creator, spirit of the universe approach to God. You know, the ocean, you know, a very elemental form of God. You know, the sky and the ocean and the trees. You know, there's just no problem that I have that is bigger than those things. So when I look at the ocean and I look at my problem, I say, okay, God, you can have it. You are okay, you're bigger again. And which of course, you know, leads right into step three. And you know, and about the insanity thing, you know, refer back to powerlessness and unmanageability. I had been insane for a long time. And sometimes I hear people come in and they say, I just want my old life back. You know what? I never had a life that was worth having back. I wanted a brand new model. And so when it says restore me to sanity, that was going to be a new adventure for me because I felt like I had never been sane. You know, I grew up in this disease. I have the disease. I felt like I had never experienced anything that I would ever want to go back to. So in step three, you know, I looked at the, you know, the mystical thought of, you know, turning it over. And I said, you know, what does that mean? And, you know, I wasn't exactly sure. I didn't know what turning it over meant. And basically what she explained to me then was that I simply had to make a decision to finish the steps. And that's all I needed to do. And that's all I needed to know. We got on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And she instructed me to continue getting on my knees and to continue saying that prayer. And you know, that prayer connected me with God in such a profound way because I felt like I am an ambassador of God. You know, I'm going to go out and show thy power and thy love and thy way of life. Like I'm on a mission. It suddenly gave me like some kind of importance. Like God thinks enough of me that I get to go and be an example. So I had better really kind of try to get this right. And today I know, you know, the third step is just an absolute stepping stone. And I love what the 12 and 12 discusses about the third step is it says, you know, we have to make a constant and persistent effort at step three because the rest of our program is going to rest on how well we continue to surrender. That is a big responsibility. You know, that's a lot of pressure. But the fact is I have a forgiving and loving God, and I don't have to be perfect, but I do have to do the right things. You know, God feeds the birds, but he doesn't necessarily bring it to the nest. So I have a proactive approach to my recovery. I do feel like, you know, that my recovery is absolutely my responsibility. In step four, when I did my very first step four, I did it in a very quick amount of time. I did not hang around long enough to know that I was supposed to whine and procrastinate. And so I just sat down and I just started writing it. And truth be told, I thought, thank God, somebody finally wants to hear my story, you know? Finally, somebody wants to know how wronged I've been done and how, you know, mean everybody's been and all these mistakes that everybody else has made and how badly I've suffered. And I made these lists and, you know, people and places and things and institutions and the insurance company and the DMV and just everybody. And what and one other thing I'll tell you about this. The last sibling that died, died when I was 90 days sober as I was writing this fourth step. On a Sunday night, he didn't feel so good, and this was a case, at least a case a day drinker times 35 years. He didn't feel well, so he went and laid on the couch and didn't drink that night. That's a big red flag. So I went out to go see him that Monday, and by Thursday we buried him from multi-organ system failure. So on Monday night, Tuesday night, and Wednesday night, I sat at his bedside. He had lost consciousness. He had gotten toxic. He couldn't communicate. All he did was just lay there and breathe and kind of just shut down. And I sat in the chair beside his bed, and I wrote my fourth step. And it just had to be that clear to me. I needed that front row seat to where I was going to be if I ever picked up again. And so I got that fourth step written. And when she came over to do my fifth step, and we sat down on my couch with, you know, our cups of coffee, we sat down and she discussed, you know, said, Lee, this is what we're doing. And I had already read, and, you know, I knew I was going to have to tell her some things. And one of the very first things she said, what is it that you're thinking about not telling me today? Ooh. Well, yeah, you think I'm going to tell you? What's she going to say? Well, here's a hint. You probably did it too. How's that? Or something like it. And I told her that. And so from that point on, everything else was just downhill. And she had this red ink pen. And as I would flip pages and tell her everything that had been done to me, she would write things on my inventory like, you picked him. She would write things like self-centered fear. She wrote things like, trusted the untrustworthy, relied on the unreliable, expectations. You don't like her because you don't like you, and she reminds you of you. So here we are. She's blowing my fifth step up, you know? I mean, by the end of it, I was like, I know. I picked him, you know? So by the end of it, my patterns had emerged, and I did have a very, very clear idea of what my character defects were, and I had a lot of faulty belief systems, and I had, you know, a great deal of dishonesty in my life. But that day, I told her everything that there was to tell, and she told me, you know, I followed the instructions in the book. I read, you know, I went and reread what I was supposed to reread. I sat quietly for an hour. And did I leave anything out? You know, I got to make sure that my keystone and my arch and my walk to freedom and, you know, just make sure everything's okay. And I sat quietly for an hour and I said, you know, I just don't have anything else to give. You know, this is it. And I went to bed that night, and somewhere in the a.m., the second most profound spiritual thing that's ever happened to me in my life happened. I was awoken by another spiritual voice. I sat straight up in bed, and God told me, you are never alone again. In that moment, I knew that anywhere I was to ever go in my life, there was going to be somebody in AA to meet me there. And to this day, that has always been true. If I have the courage to show up and tell you what is going on with me, somebody's going to pull me aside after the meeting if they don't share it during the meeting, and they're going to say, I know exactly how you feel, and you're going to be okay. Or this is what I did. Or perhaps you should pray. There's going to be somebody that's going to understand somewhere, and it's my responsibility to show up and make sure that you know what's going on with me. Because you know, it is the secrets that keep us sick. It are the things that, you know, don't see the light of day that do have an opportunity to grow and destroy. And you know, today I know, and, you know, I did my seventh step prayer, and today I do know a little bit more about six and seven, you know, through step studies and having reworked the steps. And I know today that six, you know, those character defects and that willingness, you know, those were survival skills. They were just overused. They had been taken to such extremes that they had turned against me, just like that alcohol had done. And it takes, you know, a new level of willingness and a new level of surrender to let those things go, because I wanted to let go of the alcohol when it had done me wrong. Now these things are doing me wrong. These are no longer my solutions. Just like the alcohol was a solution at some point in time, so were these character defects. They probably got me fed. They may have kept me from dying at some point in time. But the fact is, it was time to put them in their proper perspective. You know, these are basic human instincts gone bad. And in step seven, you know, I said my prayer that night and I moved on. And all I really knew about step seven at that time is that whatever I'm thinking, I probably need to do the opposite. That's all I knew. I knew that my thinking had gotten me nowhere. And if I was thinking about doing something, I needed to check with my sponsor so I could get set on the right path, so we could talk about things like motives and expectations. And, you know, sometimes I want to predict outcomes. I want guarantees and, you know, manipulate and all that stuff. And so we talk about the things that we need to talk about before, you know, before I would do them. And today I know actually how the seventh step really reads, you know, that little paragraph. I know today what it really says. It says that I am supposed to ask for my character defects to be removed, not for my comfort, but so that I may be of maximum service. You know, I thought it was all about me. And it's not, you know, it's not to make me a better person or to, you know, make me 5'7" and willowy. It's to make me of maximum service to you. And I'm so grateful to be of maximum service to you tonight, and especially the girl that couldn't come from California. And because I know for me, if for some reason I can't show up for an AA commitment, I do feel a little better when I know that it's covered. And I was always told to show up for service. You have to be sick, dead, or out of town to not show up for service. And when I moved on to the eighth step, I did have, you know, a great deal of amends to make. And I didn't really hesitate making that list. You know, I had caught the AA bug. I was in it. I was ready. I wanted to belong. I wanted to be a good, upstanding member of AA. And I felt like the way to do that was to make this list and, you know, and talk about that forgiveness and that freedom. So when I went and I started making my amends, the way I was taught to make amends is, you know, there's no room for the words "I'm sorry." The fact is I had used all my "I'm sorry" credits up long ago. The way I was taught to make my amends is to discuss it in a calm, open, and frank manner, to talk about what the incident was, what my role in the incident was, what I plan to do about it, and is there anything else that I can do to make it right, and will you please forgive me? There's no "I'm sorry" in that. So I went to my dad, you know, and I went to my mother's grave, and I went to those places that, you know, I just kind of started small, and then I continued to branch out. Didn't have a whole lot of financial amends. I had always kind of overcompensated in that area because I grew up in such financial insecurity. I had kind of hit the opposite end of it because I didn't ever want to ask anybody for anything. So I didn't really owe a whole lot of money, but what I did, I was told to get it paid immediately. So I kind of funneled my funds, you know, into that area until I could know that I was squared up completely. And today what I know about forgiveness and freedom is just a little, you know, kind of some added bonus. I know today that forgiveness is really, you know, no gift to the person that you're forgiving. It's a gift to yourself. I know that when I harbor the spirit of unforgiveness to someone, I cannot effectively release them to God. I am keeping them hostage because I want to control them. I still want to control that offense. I still want to control that situation. And I'm just going to say this. There were things that happened in my household that should have never happened. My brothers did things they should have never done. But the bottom line is it's time to let them go. And it's time to let them go to God. And that I've been working on this relationship with God, and it's time to just move on. And the eighth and ninth step tells me that I get the opportunity to choose the kind of person that I want to be today. I get to live out loud. You know, my actions get to speak louder than my words for the very first time in my life. And I really like having that life 101 to go by. You know, you guys tell me how to act. You tell me how to show up. And my sister, I have a difficult relationship with one of my sisters, and I called her up and I told her I needed to have lunch with her, and she just flat out told me, she said, you know, I don't really know what you're doing and I don't really care. I just know that you need to leave the past in the past and don't call me. And, you know, I had been on and off her couch for years, and we had a sordid history, and I had to let that go. And I called my sponsor. I'm like, does she not know that she was next on the list? Does she not know I need to get this done? Does she not know that you said I had to? And what she told me is, she said, what you're supposed to do is follow her instructions. She gave you your instructions on how to make the amends. You leave her alone. So here we are, 6.5 years later, and the way that I have amended my relationship with my sister is I've done these crazy little things, like I know she goes to lunch at 1 o'clock, and I just show up in the parking lot and ask her if I can take her to lunch. And I don't talk about anything about me. I just ask her how her day is. You know, I've shown up for her children today. And I got to say that she calls me when things are really bad, because she knows that I'm going to answer the phone, and she knows that I'm going to show up, and she knows that I'm not going to give a whole bucket load of unsolicited advice. I'm just going to say, I love you, and I hope that you want better things than what you've got, but it's up to you. And, you know, whatever she chooses for her life is what she chooses for her life. And giving her the dignity of her process is the very best amends that I have ever given her. In step 10, 11, and 12, you know, that's where, you know, initially in step 10, that's where I was told, you know, by now your obsession's been removed and, you know, things are looking pretty good. You've cleared up your past. It's time to maintain the present. And it told me that when fear and dishonesty and self-centeredness, when those things cropped up, not if. So it told me that I was going to have some work to do. I was going to have some continuing maintenance to do. And you know, initially I started off with a lot of written inventories, and today I know that I prefer a spot check inventory. I do much better just kind of checking in throughout the day and doing what needs to be done promptly. You know, not waiting until 10 or 11 o'clock at night and writing it down on a piece of paper and, you know, doing this and that. It just works better if I just kind of keep up with it as I go. Step 11 has always been an absolute pleasure. You know, I've got this best friend. I've got a wonderful God today, and I really have a different way of meditating than I ever thought that I would have. I always thought meditation, you know, was going to require some little thin, naked Indian man in a room of in a hut with incense, you know. But that's really not the case at all. For me, moving meditation works. You know, when I go for a long run, my clarity comes. My head clears when my body moves. And I figured that out by, you know, redeveloping hobbies in recovery. Step 12, the thing I'd like to share about step 12, you know, initially I thought that meant sponsorship. I thought that whenever, you know, I turned 1 year that there were going to be people lining up wanting me to sponsor them. And what really happened is that I was taught just to show up on a regular basis and to make coffee and fill a seat and continue to practice these principles in all my affairs. I didn't really have a good concept of what that was in the beginning. And today, the thing that I'm really excited to share with you is I just recently had a major amount of clarity about step 12, about practicing these principles in all my affairs. I've joined this group at the YMCA that I've been going to for about the last 3 years, and it's a triathlon group. And I'm very excited to share that I will be doing my first triathlon next month. And I've been training for it for quite a while, and it's kind of interesting because, follow me here, what has happened is because you have taught me to get a sponsor, ask for direction, follow suggestions, do service work, get a network, all those things. What I did is I applied all of those principles to that little triathlon group. My coaches, they have no idea they're really my sponsors. Don't tell them. You know, and I take their suggestions and I ask for help, and I've made a few friends in that group that I can say, you know, how do you do this, or, you know, what do you do when? And showing up in this fellowship on a regular basis taught me how to show up other places on a regular basis and actually make a few friends and say, I don't know. Please help me. I'm scared. I went out on a road ride the other day on my bicycle. Be nice to cyclists, please. And and I'm out there riding, and I kept telling this girl, I'm scared. She's like, just come on. And then a little while later in the ride, she said, how are you doing? I said, I think I almost had fun. But, you know, just to be able to freely share that and, you know, say, I'm scared, you know, instead of going out there and trying to act all tough, you know, like I'm not, and then falling and... making myself vulnerable to the process is what I'm saying about practicing the principles in all my affairs. As I mentioned earlier, I have remarried in recovery at 18 months, you know, at legal dating age. I had worked the steps. I had worked the traditions. I did have to change sponsors, just circumstances. You know, we hit a crossroads, and that's okay. And I got a different sponsor, and I had kind of been going to some different meetings, and I go to this meeting one night, and I sit down in this circle, and I look straight across the circle, and there was the smile that I'm seeing right now, and I said, I am in trouble. I had not dated in recovery, and I just knew at that moment that just, you know, bluebirds chirped and all that stuff, you know. I just knew that I really wanted to get to know this guy, and come to find out, you know, he had long-term sobriety, and, you know, he was single. And we did this really crazy thing. We dated. We did not move in together the first week that we knew each other. You laugh because you identify. And we sought our own relationship with God, and we leaned heavily on our sponsors during our first year of our relationship. We did move in together, and about a month after we moved in together, we got engaged, and we stayed engaged for about a year, and then we got married. We've been married for 3 years, and we've been together for 5. So it's been a very interesting road, being in a relationship in recovery, and I would absolutely encourage everyone to continue to seek your own relationship with God before you seek relationships with other people. One thing I will add is I am a friend of Lois's also. I grew up, you know, absolutely in an alcoholic home, and I'm affected by it in every area of my life. And that has been an asset to my 12-step growth. My dad, he is my best friend today. At some point in time during these last 6.5 years, I showed up and I cleaned his house, and he turned into this little old man who's 77 years old, who teeters around on a walker, who will sneak and tell you a dirty joke when nobody's listening. And he loves my husband. They're best friends. And today I can take him to doctor's appointments, and I can go and change the sheets on his bed, and I can take him to lunch. And, you know, I can do those things that, you know, a daughter's supposed to do for her dad. And I found out, you know, somewhere along the line that, you know, my dad really did do the best that he could with what he had to work with. And I found out that I did too. And for the first time in our lives, we have coexisted for the last 6 years when we were both sober. Now, he doesn't go to church anymore, but he doesn't go to AA. He doesn't really do a whole lot. He has his routines, and that's what works for him. And it's so funny because I asked him one time, just one time, I said, Daddy, why don't you ever go to Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, because somebody might think I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, the thing I just can't, you know, I don't have the heart to break to him is that everybody already knew. But I do love my father very much, and we are best friends today. I have a beautiful stepdaughter, and she's just a great friend to me today, and it's a pleasure to be of service to her through this fellowship. And I got to say that there's just nothing better than being able to show up for you people and for God. And there's not a whole lot else I think that I need to say tonight. One thing I always do when I speak is I do like to close very quickly with a quick reading. You've got part of it in your pamphlet there. This is from page 164. It's the last two paragraphs of A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thank you very much.